All right, well, thank you all for being here. I'm very excited to share my research on thinking about chemicals within the consumer products. First, my kind of obligatory disclosure slide here, that I have no financial relationships or commercial interests. Okay, so why think about hormone disruptors and asthma-associated chemicals in consumer products to begin with? Our research at Silent Spring Institute, through our household exposure studies, as well as others, other studies out there, have shown that we're widely exposed to consumer product chemicals in our home. We know, we can find phthalates in our air and our dust and other chemicals. We also know this, that based on the CDC's National Biomonitoring Program, the NHANES program, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, that we know that those chemicals from consumer products are in us. And because of this, the thought is, well, what can we do to try to reduce our exposures to these chemicals that we are finding both in our homes and in our bodies? There's kind of two options, I guess you could put out there, for thinking about coming up with strategies for reducing our exposure to chemicals. We could kind of take a regulatory approach, either at the federal level or other levels of the government, or we could take a personal or individual level approach. Unfortunately, as probably Dr. Dennison will tell us, the kind of the regulatory structure right now in the U.S. isn't kind of prime for this, thinking about consumer product chemicals. So unfortunately, we're kind of left with the consumer to make the decisions by themselves. Hopefully, with different tools that might be available to the consumer to make informed decisions. But really, it comes down to thinking about what we can do to try to make change, to affect change in a landscape where the change is not possible right now from a regulatory perspective. And we also know this, that based on the work that we do when we go into people's homes and think about household exposures, we know that people really want to know how they can reduce their exposure. And so we wanted to come up with some real evidence-based or research-based recommendations for reducing our exposure to chemicals. And to do that, we tried to actually first reach out to different consumer consumer product manufacturers and ask them what was in their products so we can make informed decisions. And then you might guess we didn't get very far with that line. So instead, we were left with our only option, and unfortunately a rather expensive option, was to actually test the products themselves. So we did that. We took 50 different product types, and we sent them off to the lab to get tested because we wanted to know what exactly was in those products. So we sent off cosmetics, so anything from perfumes to makeups, things like that, cleaning products. We sent off household goods like shower curtains and kitty litter. We sent off things that you might use to make your own cleaners at home, say. And we also sent off some sunscreens to get tested at the lab. Products were tested for, analyzed for 66 different chemicals, many of which are endocrine disruptors, but also asthma-associated chemicals. You can see here, I'm just listing the major classes here. So we have those endocrine disrupting compounds, and then we have compound groups like phthalates, fragrances, and glycol ethers that might be both associated with endocrine disruption as well as asthma-associated, and then some ethanolamines associated with asthma. So off they went to the lab. And while I've highlighted on the previous slide the chemical classes that we looked at, here's a little bit more detail, and I realize this is quite dense, this information here, but I wanted to kind of highlight a couple of things. First of all, you can see that within a particular chemical class, we looked at several different types. So phthalates, right, we looked at many different types of phthalates. You can see their uses, their general uses, and then our potential health concerns of why they kind of made it onto our list. So, right, we were looking at parabens, phthalates, bisphenol A, antimicrobials such as triclosan and triclocarban, ethanolamines, which are sometimes used as solvents and cleaners. We also looked at alkylphenols, which have been associated, some have been associated with endocrine disruption. We looked at a wide range of fragrances, and here we are separating them as based on natural or synthetic. And I should say that these are based on groupings based on what we believe their primary origin are. We did not test these for their exact origin, whether or not they were natural or synthetic, but this is based on kind of general knowledge out there that most of those right in the synthetic category have to be made in a lab. Well, we can find some of those natural fragrances out there in plants and whatnot. So those are kind of the larger groups. You can see we're looking at quite a fair amount of fragrances here. And then rounding out the list, there are the glycol ethers, perfluorinated chemicals, we looked for one, cycloxyloxane, and UV filters. And just a note here, there's some of these that we introduced in a second round of sampling, so you're going to see not as many kind of hits on those. It's basically because we got so excited about our results, we sent off a whole other set of products to the lab and expanded our analyte list. Okay, so that's where we're coming from, 66 chemicals, 50 different product types. And then now a note on study design. We had two kind of goals when we were thinking about this, trying to understand how we're exposed to chemicals in consumer products. The first was, what are our typical exposures, right? So what are our exposures, your kind of average typical American exposures to chemicals in consumer products? To do that, we looked at 170 different conventional products that we actually composited down into different product types. So, right, we didn't want to it's very expensive. We didn't want to test every single laundry detergent available at your local grocery store, right? So instead, to try to understand our general exposure to laundry detergents, chemicals that might be in laundry detergents, we took, say, four laundry detergents, composited them, and analyzed them as one sample, because we're interested in kind of typical exposures, okay? Those are what we're calling our conventional products. And those were selected basically based on market share, so the major players in the area. And then we have 43 alternative products that were analyzed individually. Now, the goal here is that we wanted to find a specific product that we believed to have little or no chemicals of concern, so we could, say, either recommend that product or use that in an exposure reduction study of some sort. Okay, so we needed to know exactly what was in that product. So we sent those off as individual samples. So just a note on study design that has some limitations in how we're going to interpret these results. Okay. But that being said, first a note on how we actually came up with these alternative product criteria. So this is based on our research, our household exposure research. We came up with things that we did not want to be in our products. So we went off to the stores and found products that did not contain parabens, ethanolamines, dichlorobenzene. So these are all things that are pretty much on our chemicals of concern list. The non-ion surfactants, that's going after the alkyl phenols. The fragrances, although we did allow some natural or essential oil fragrances. Tea tree oil, lavender. The antimicrobials, so things labeled as antibacterial we avoided. Stain-resistant characteristics, anything made of vinyl and things that are petroleum-based. And I should say that most of our products were purchased at a nationwide natural food product store. So they met their criteria, which mostly at the time was that they had to be plant-based. So here's a look at the results, and I realize this is really dense, and I'm going to walk you through it. So here we have, along the bottom of the figure here, we have the different product types. So you can see 43 different product types, everything from cat litter, pillow protectors, diapers, all the way down to the end, which is sunscreen. The little number after it is how many were within that particular sample. Okay, cat litter, there's a 3. We looked at 3 different cat litters. Then along the left-hand side here, the y-axis, those are all the chemicals that we were looking for, okay, and I've grouped them by chemical class. And basically what you're looking at here is that the intensity of color, the intensity of orange in this case, is the concentration, okay? So the darker the orange, the higher the concentrations that we found. Okay, so this is really dense. This is one of the figures in our paper that was published in Environmental Health Perspectives if you really want to dig in on your favorite product or your favorite chemical. I'll just highlight two examples here, the first being bis-2-ethylhexylphthalate, also known as DHP. It's an antiandrogen, also been associated with asthma. We found that in a pillow protector at about 14% by weight. So here we have, unfortunately, a product in which is generally kind of recommended towards asthmatics to get pillow protectors to reduce your exposure to dust mites, unfortunately containing DHP, which can exacerbate asthma. Kind of an unfortunate replacement there. And then just kind of other interesting note is we found antimicrobials, kind of not surprising, in triclosan and triclocarban in both our hand soaps and bar soaps. Kind of not surprising given how much you see antibacterial soaps out there. So here now are our results for alternative products. Again, these are products in which we went out, you know, PhDs in environmental health sciences went out and tried to select these products based on their labels. Could we do it? Again, set up the same way where intensity of color is showing the concentration. And you can see kind of a quick glance, right? There's a lot less blue on the slide than there was the orange on the last. So we did all right. In fact, about 11 of the products that we looked at, we found no chemicals of concern. which is a good thing. There's a lot on here to kind of think about. I'll just point out one example here. Interesting results here. There's three phthalates here that I'm starring, which was kind of interesting in that we found these particular phthalates, this dicyclohexyl phthalate, the isononyl, and the N-propyl. We only found them in our alternative products. We never found them in our conventional products. It's kind of interesting. These phthalates are kind of lesser known than the other phthalates. Unfortunately, are also androgenic, which raises questions about whether or not they might be kind of a substitution. Kind of, let's move off the radar here. So what are kind of a summary of findings, major findings here? So of the 66 chemicals that we looked for, we found 55 of them. We found chemicals in all of the conventional products. We found 11 alternative products that had no chemicals of concern. The highest concentrations, when we think about it in terms of a chemical perspective, were for DHP, so like that pillow protector having 14% by weight. Fragrances, DEA, so that's a diethanolamine, typically used as a solvent. Glycol ethers, again, solvent. And UV filters, because they're typically used as active ingredients in sunscreens. In terms of the products, the product types with the largest numbers and highest concentrations were for sunscreens and fragrance products. The fragrance probably not surprising. We looked at a lot of fragrances, so that's going to pop up. But certainly the concentrations that we were finding were high relative to the other ones. Vinyl products. Anybody who studies vinyl products, that probably isn't that surprising to you. But it is kind of a word of caution there, right? We vinyl products. We actually found our vinyl shower curtain to contain 28% by weight DEHP. So it's a quarter of that vinyl shower curtain is DEHP, an antiandrogen. And then as I brought up on the last slide, this idea of substitutions, we're kind of swapping things out here, it seems, in the consumer product landscape. Just a note on mixtures. We did look at mixtures. The idea here is that not only are we're exposed to a lot of chemicals at the same time, right? So any product type would have, say, zero, nothing in it, all the way up to 22 of our chemicals of concern. We did do some correlation analyses, which one interesting finding was finding that DEP, so diethyl phthalate, was very found correlated with many of the fragrance compounds. So those typically found together. The idea that on our typical day, so if you're using, even if you're an informed, mindful shopper and using alternative products, alternative based on our criteria, if you're using your kind of a typical array of products, right, surface cleaner, tub and tile, laundry, bar soap, shampoo, conditioner, facial cleanser, lotion, toothpaste, you're exposed to up to 19 chemicals of concern. And this has real implications when we think about toxicity testing. So what should we be actually testing? Is it the mixtures? Is it the individual chemicals? That has implications for risk assessment when we think about cumulative effects based on health effects, and then also in for epidemiology when we think about mixtures and potential for confounding. Just a quick note, while we looked at the actual concentrations of these chemicals within the products, we also wanted to see how well these concentrations that we found, whether or not they could be essentially predicted, or what the concordance was with the label themselves. So we looked at whether or not it was listed on the label and then whether or not we found it in the product, when the labels actually had any information. And you will hear that many labels do not have to have much information on them. And we found it's kind of a yes or no kind of answer. Generally, we could not avoid, the labels did nothing to help us and try to think about avoiding phthalates, ethanolamines, and alkyl phenols. Well, the labels were generally better in thinking about avoiding parabens, antimicrobials or antibacterial agents, and UV filters. And just what this might mean is it means that the consumer, unfortunately, doesn't have a lot of information at hand. It also means that while the online rating systems do a very good job of aggregating a huge amount of information, that they themselves are left at the same amount, have the same information that we have, is that they rely on the labels themselves. So they're only as good as the labels. So broader conclusions. The idea here is that exposures add up for multiple products. Toxicity studies and risk assessments are needed for mixtures. We need to think about how we're exposed to many of these compounds at the same time. In terms of epidemiology, it raises concerns about confounding. DEP being shown as a marker for fragrance, right? What's the real bad actor there? Is it DEP or is it the fragrance? The potential for misclassification due to variation in product composition, the idea is that self-report, just the fact, did you use laundry detergent today or not, that may lead to some variation because of product composition and rather misclassification. Labels, we've learned, may facilitate consumer choice for some chemicals, but not all. Generally, if they're active ingredients and they have to be labeled under FDA. And that if you're going to right now think of things that you could do to make a change, the focus should be on vinyl products, fragrance products, thinking about or reducing the number of products that you use, and thinking about alternatives to sunscreens. So as part of our kind of we do a lot of work in thinking about doing research within the community. We always try to translate our findings. So as part of our paper release, so we publish this right in EHP, while we do the scientific paper release, we also want to translate this. We need to think about using some of these tips, which are various things that you should choose and avoid. We even have developed a wallet card if you want to learn more. And I encourage you to visit our website, specifically to check out our new, what we call our microsite, Too Close to Home, where we've actually aggregated the tips from all of our studies, not only for the consumer product study, but also all of our studies. So that's it. Thank you very much. In this case, we looked at both the scientific literature as well as some regulatory bodies that have identified as endocrine disruptors. We're thinking broadly here in terms of things that might affect the estrogen system, the androgen system, as well as the thyroid system. But some of that, we've provided citations for all of our, whenever we've asserted that something's an endocrine disruptor.
And you know that, I'm sure that in real actual bodies, the question wouldn't be just has the body taken in and
Most certainly. Yep.
In a thyroid disruptor that moves your TSH 0.001 units, that doesn't mean anything?
Yep, I understand that. And we've also tried to highlight when we've relied on animal studies or in vitro studies, as well as human studies.
Okay, similar, sorry to just go on for another minute.
Yeah, so we can discuss this again at the end of this session. I think she answered your question, and there's some other people waiting. So.
All right. Could you clarify what products have to be labeled fully and which ones can get away without labeling? And does the public have any recourse to get the complete labeling when it's required?
Sure, I'll address that now, although I think some of our panelists have probably some answers there. In general, cosmetics have more regulations in terms of their labeling compared to cleaning products. So FDA regulates cosmetics differently than cleaning products. And so it depends on their jurisdiction. If things alter your body's physiology in some way, they have to be labeled. Those are the active ingredients in products. So that's the UV filters and the antimicrobials. Similarly, if it's acting as a like a pesticide within a cleaning product, it has to be labeled because it's a pesticide. So if there are antimicrobials or bacteria in the cleaning products, they have to be labeled. But otherwise, the labeling is really kind of all over the map, and it depends on who the jurisdictions, kind of the regulatory authorities on that. I think probably Cal can answer that to better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great, so let's move on. Those are some big issues that have been raised already that we can come back to at the end.